The top story this week was the rocket launch in North Korea, which just failed. The White House is calling the coverage propaganda. We'll discuss it with the Christian Science Monitor's Don Kirk. The Huffington Post's Michael McAuliffe will be here to talk about coverage of the recently passed Jobs Act. The White House says it'll create jobs, while critics say it legalizes even more stock market fraud. So where are the facts? And ProPublica's Paul Keel will talk about coverage of the ongoing foreclosure crisis. He's out with a lengthy piece about the struggle for justice and a place to call home. What was your story of the week? Join us after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. The British Prime Minister David Cameron says he supports a suspension of sanctions except for the ban on the sale of arms. He was speaking after talks in Rangoon with the democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. As Rachel Harvey reports, suspending sanctions could boost development.
Potentially, this could allow European companies to do business within Burma, which to this point they have been heavily discouraged from doing. It will also allow for more direct investment and more aid and more expertise, and that is arguably what is most needed within Burma, is expertise on everything from how to govern, how to run a parliament, how to reform an economy, how to get a banking system going. And up to this point, there have been restrictions on that kind of training and expertise.
Ms. Suu Kyi herself said such a suspension would strengthen the position of the reform movement. Activists in Syria say several people have been shot dead during demonstrations after Friday prayers. Reports say the security forces fired into the air to disperse crowds as they left their mosques, but in some cases they killed and injured demonstrators. Today's protests were seen as a major test of the ceasefire, which has been in place since Thursday morning, as part of a peace plan negotiated by the international envoy Kofi Annan. He urged the UN Security Council to send monitors. His spokesman, Ahmed Fawzi, said an advance team was standing by.
The Department of Peacekeeping Operations is working around the clock to find the necessary number of troops for the full observer mission eventually. At the moment, we have the advance team standing by to board planes and to get themselves on the ground as soon as possible.
South Sudan has outlined the circumstances in which it would withdraw from the disputed Heglig oil field following days of clashes with Sudan. The details came in a presidential statement after the African Union criticized both countries. James Copnell reports from Khartoum.
South Sudan says it is prepared to withdraw its forces from Heglig, according to a presidential press statement. However, this could only happen in two circumstances. The first is if the South Sudanese can be sure Heglig will not be used as a base for cross-border raids against them. The second is if United Nations troops were deployed in the area until a political solution is found. However, Sudan is extremely unlikely to agree to UN peacekeepers in Heglig. The African Union Peace and Security Council called it an illegal and unacceptable occupation.
James Copnell. A coalition of 17 aid agencies has warned that poor rainfall forecast for the coming months could threaten Somalia's recovery from last year's famine. They say the food crisis in Somalia is likely to be prolonged, increasing the number of people in need of aid. Last year's drought was the worst in the Horn of Africa for decades. This is the World News coming to you from the BBC. Reports from Guinea-Bissau say rebellious soldiers have arrested both the president and prime minister. The Prime Minister, Carlos Gomez Jr., was tipped to win this month's presidential election, but upset officers with his plans to trim the army. They accuse him of bringing in Angolan troops. Richard Hamilton reports.
A resident of the capital, Bissau, told me that power had been cut off in the centre of the city and that the atmosphere on the streets outside was extremely tense. She said the street where the former Prime Minister, Carlos Gomez Jr., lived had been sealed off by soldiers. She said state radio had come back on air and had opened with a statement from the military that was read out by a journalist. It said the military command did not want power but was forced to act because the government was, in its words, aiming to annihilate the armed forces using foreign military force.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says it's concerned at the growing number of people fleeing the fighting in northwest Pakistan between government troops and Islamist militants. The agency said about 10,000 new arrivals a day were being registered at a camp near Peshawar. It said more than 180,000 people had been displaced since fighting intensified in January. Portugal has become the second country after Greece to ratify two European Union treaties intended to stabilise the financial situation in the Eurozone. The treaties, dealing with financial stability and budget discipline, are part of an EU pact signed in March, which will come into force once it's been ratified by 12 countries. The United States has apologised to the Indian actor Shah Rukh Khan over his detention by US immigration officials on Thursday. The Bollywood star was held for 2 hours at a New York airport after arriving for an engagement at Yale University. The US embassy in Delhi said it was sorry for any inconvenience to Mr. Khan. The last time Mr. Khan was held by US immigration in 2009, he suggested it was because he was a Muslim. That's the BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The rocket launch in North Korea got wall-to-wall coverage in the U.S. media this week. For the first time ever, North Korea allowed 200 foreign journalists to cover the event. The White House is calling the coverage propaganda. The launch broke into several pieces and plunged into the Yellow Sea between the South Korea and China border just a month after it took off. Today's guest, Donald Kirk, reports that the failure of the rocket, which North Korea said would put a weather satellite into orbit, comes as a huge embarrassment for North Korea during the buildup for massive celebrations Sunday, marking the 100th anniversary of the birth of the North's founding leader, Kim Il-sung. Don Kirk reports that the failed rocket could lead to a fresh nuclear test. So what explains the wall-to-wall coverage? How significant is it that North Korea allowed 200 foreign journalists to cover this event? Don Kirk is the Korea correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he joins us from Seoul, South Korea. Hi, Don. Welcome back to the show.
Right. Good morning from Seoul.
Good morning, and thanks for staying up to be on the show. So give us the latest. How is this launch being covered in South Korea, where you are?
Well, it's gotten a tremendous amount of coverage, of course. I think that basically South Koreans think the North Koreans are rather crazy, actually. That seems to be the one reaction that I keep hearing here. It's had to compete, by the way, for coverage with the National Assembly elections here, in which the conservatives unexpectedly won a majority in the assembly. The Liberal Democratic Party had been expected finally to take a majority, but the conservatives surprised them. And the main considerations here seem to be economic concerns, liberals hoping to win votes as a result of the economic concerns of young people and so forth. So the North Korean missile shot is not the only big news here as far as the South Koreans are concerned. The conservative Democratic battle for seats in the National Assembly is equally important, if not more important.
But we're not getting much coverage of that in the U.S. So what explains...
Maybe none.
Maybe none. What explains the conservative win, and what does this mean for South Korea?
Well, the conservative win simply reflects the reluctance of people to go along with calls for sweeping changes that might undermine the pillars of the South Korean economy, namely the chaebol, the great conglomerates that dominate the economy. However, the Liberals have been, and Democratic Party have been making inroads because they say that the government of President Lee Myung-bak vastly favors the big business interests. President Lee himself comes from the background as a former chairman of Hyundai Construction, the largest construction company, and once a pillar of the Hyundai empire. So you know, there's all that concern here. That's not to say that North Korea is not an issue. Liberals or Democrats, I'm not quite sure how to call them. Some people might say leftists, but I, you know, hesitate to use that term. Liberals or Democrats might say that South Korea should make better effort to negotiate with North Korea. North Korea will not negotiate with President Lee. He's adopted what's regarded as a hardline position and refused food and other aid to North Korea.
And I want to let listeners know that Donald Kirk will be with us for about the next 15 to 20 minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about coverage of the rocket launch in North Korea, it got wall-to-wall coverage. What did you make of it? What questions do you have? And also, if you have any questions about what's going on with the South Korean elections, which are not getting much attention in this country, now would be a good time to give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Don, how much of what is happening in South Korea with this election, how much of that influences the political landscape in North Korea?
I don't think it influences the political landscape in North Korea at all. The question is whether what's going on in North Korea influences the political landscape in South Korea. But North Korea is so cut off from the rest of the world that I don't think that what's happening in South Korea is influencing North Korea. However, I should point out that South Korean broadcasts do get into North Korea. There are several small shortwave radio stations that broadcast into North Korea, and Voice of America and Radio Free Asia also broadcast into North Korea. Now, it's illegal for North Koreans to listen to these broadcasts, and, you know, most of them don't have the necessary equipment anyway, the radios that they can pick them up. There's a whole issue of getting batteries for the radios and so forth. You can't just plug in a radio into a power source in North Korea because most houses don't have plug-in power sources. Hmm. So some information is getting into North Korea more than used to get into North Korea a few years ago. This may have some influence, but you won't see it directly. The regime still imposes the most draconian penalties. There are still huge, sprawling prison camps where as many as 200,000 political prisoners are held, and perhaps tens of thousands of others held in other forms of camps. So in other words, South Korea is not influencing North Korea directly, except perhaps to entice increasing numbers of defectors to cross the Tumen and Yala River borders into China in an effort to get through China and on to South Korea.
This is really fascinating because North Korea is at the very bottom of the Freedom of Press Index list. And a number of outlets recently have been writing about what you just said, about the fact that there are more citizen journalists in North Korea getting information out. And then also in South Korea, you have people putting DVDs of information together and they're getting them into North Korea. And I also found it fascinating that the government of North Korea gives all citizens a radio with propaganda, and there's no on or off button, just a volume button?
Well, not only that, but of course, you can turn down the volume, of course, but not only that, these radios and also television sets only have have the ability to tune into the government, to the state channels and the state stations. Now, if you're very clever, and of course I'm sure that some people are quite clever, you can rejigger these sets in order to listen to other stuff. As far as television is concerned, North Koreans along the borders with South Korea and also along the border with China like to pick up Chinese and South Korean broadcasts, television broadcasts. But all that's very illegal and very risky.
Right.
And it's not something that, you know, happens all the time or even much of the time.
We need to do a show about North Korea because these articles about what goes on behind the scenes are just fascinating, especially about how people are trying to get information in and out. So let's talk about what happened this week. The rocket launch got so much attention in the United States. For the first time ever, North Korea allowed 200 foreign journalists to cover the event. And according to an AP report, the press bus took a wrong turn on Thursday, and suddenly everything changed in the official showcase of North Korean achievement. A cloud of brown dust swirled down deeply potholed streets past concrete apartment buildings crumbling at the edges. Old people trudged along the sidewalk, some with a handmade backpack. Two men in wheelchairs waited at a bus stop. There were stores with no lights and side roads so battered there were more dirt than pavement. Ordinary North Koreans stared unabashedly at the 50 or so foreign reporters on a rare trip to this secretive autocratic nation as it honors its founder and heralds its new leader. What are your thoughts about North Korea allowing these journalists to come in? And did you get an invitation? How did that work?
No, I did not get an invitation. It's extremely hard to get into North Korea. Obviously, the journalists who got in were quite carefully selected. They got CNN, BBC, I think NBC is there too, the American Wires, plus journalists from other countries. Well, BBC is British, of course, and journalists from around the world. But I don't think that a whole lot of journalists who wanted to get in got in. They pretty well fine-tuned who they let in. Of course, those journalists had to bring in crews. So by the time all that was done, there weren't slots for a lot of other journalists. So I did not, I was not able to get in. But as for the journalists who were there, they did not hear about the failure of the missile from the North Koreans initially. They heard about it from their own offices calling them to tell them to ask them what was going on and to tell them what they had heard. And when they besieged the North Koreans with questions, all of which I saw on television here, they besieged the North Koreans with questions. They didn't get any answers until finally this woman, this North Korean newsreader wearing traditional Hanbok garb, read out the announcement from the Korean Central News Agency that the missile had failed to go into it, to enter its preset orbit, as she put it. Now, that doesn't mean that she said the satellite had failed to enter its preset orbit. That does not mean that the missile was a failure, although we know it was a failure, but only that the satellite had failed. So they even covered that up. Now, the question, of course, is whether or not there was any satellite in the U.S. And in South Korea and in Japan. It's widely suspected there was no satellite. The only reason for launching this missile was to test its capability to carry a warhead a long distance, possibly as far as the U.S. West Coast.
What do you make of the White House response to this? The White House was pushing back against the media for what it sees as oversaturated coverage of the missile test. The Politico headline is White House warns media on North Korea. National Security spokesperson Tommy Vietor said, quote, "You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know this is propaganda. Reporters have to be careful not to get co-opted."
Yes, I think I can appreciate the White House concern on that issue. There was sort of a propagandistic tinge to some of the reporting. You know, North Korea invited these people in to show them its great moment, to show what a powerful and strong nation they are. Their ambition is to be a strong and powerful nation. The invitation may have boomeranged since the journalists who were there obviously had to report the failure of the missile. However, they're all going to be at the celebration on Sunday of the 100th anniversary of the birth of the great leader, so-called Kim Il-sung, who died in 1994. That will be a huge occasion, a huge propaganda spectacle. So the propaganda show will go on, and perhaps North Korea can recover some of what it's lost by the failure of the missile.
And what explains the timing of this? Why did they launch this missile now?
Well, this was really to highlight that 100th anniversary celebration.
Huh.
Kim Il-sung ruled North Korea for nearly half a century. He is virtually, in fact, deified as North Korea's great leader. His son, Kim Jong-il, took over from him in 1994. Kim Jong-il died last December. He's also deified as a great leader or dear leader. And Kim Jong-il's son, Kim Jong-un, in his late 20s, now is the new leader in this incredible dynastic succession. So they wanted to sort of make this kind of a national coming-of-age day in which, from this day on, the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, North Korea could be regarded as a strong and prosperous nation.
So they knew that the journalists wouldn't come specifically for this celebration, but they would come for the missile launch.
Well, I think the journalists would come for the celebration as well. You know, obviously, that's a good chance to take a look at a great spectacle. I had hoped to get in for the celebration, but wasn't able to. Sure, journalists would come for the celebration as well as the missile launch. They were invited to witness the missile launch, but in fact, no matter what, they weren't going to witness the launch. They went up and saw the missile on a guided tour a couple of days ago, but they weren't even informed this morning that the missile was being launched. They learned about it as noted from their home offices, and then learned minutes later that it had failed. So So they didn't witness the launch, even though North Korea promised them that they would be able to do so.
And what about coverage of the U.S.-North Korea relationship? The U.S. agreed in late February to ship 240,000 tons of food over a 12-month period, but they suspended the plan after they learned of the launch.
Yes. Obviously, the U.S. doesn't really want to go on shipping in this food while North Korea violates what the U.S. regarded as had understood to be a moratorium on missile as well as nuclear tests. So the deal was not specifically that we give you food if you carry out this moratorium. On the other hand, the general understanding was you will not conduct missile or nuclear tests, and we will give this food. Now that deal is off. That's not to say, however, that ultimately negotiations could resume and the U.S. could get around to holding out the possibility of that deal. But certainly it's off for now. And I think that what people are really wondering is whether North Korea is going to conduct a third nuclear test. They did the last nuclear test in May of 2009, 6 weeks after the launch of a similar missile, a missile that was considerably more successful. I think it went about 1,000 miles into the Western Pacific.
And Don, do you see things changing as we're getting more information out of North Korea? And it sounds like, based on a number of articles, that citizen journalists are really making a difference. They're actually learning about their country, learning they've been lied to on so many occasions, and they're able to smuggle information in and out.
Yes, I think that gradually more information is becoming available, but this is still highly limited.
Right.
But nonetheless, and so we shouldn't say that North Korea is opening up in any way, but nonetheless, in the internet age, in the age in which it's possible to have surreptitious cell phones, and in which the South Korean activists are launching balloons with dropping information pamphlets over North Korea, and in which broadcasts are getting into North Korea. In this age, it's very difficult to completely seal off a country. And I think that gradually, slowly, information is seeping into North Korea, but not on a mass scale, and certainly not without tremendous personal risk for those caught sending or receiving this information.
Well, they're putting their lives on the line by doing this.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
And
yes,
so who's making the ultimate decisions now in North Korea?
Well, that's another question. Kim Jong-un is the supreme leader, so-called. He was recently made first secretary of the Workers' Party. He's supposedly in charge of the armed forces. But the decisions are seem to be made by a small clique of generals and relatives, in-laws surrounding him. Jong Song-taek, his uncle-in-law, married to the younger sister of the late Kim Jong-il, is believed to be at the center of this cabal, so to speak, or this junta of people who exercise the real power in North Korea. On the other hand, it's not necessarily certain that Kim Jong-un is such a weakling. He may be trying to assert himself with some appointments of his own by approving shifts and so forth. Certainly by endorsing a tough line. He's been visiting military units, and he's assumed to have been very much in favor of this launch of a missile supposedly with a satellite, and he's also assumed to be very much in favor of the nuclear program. So we have to see how strong or how weak he is. That's not clear at all now.
And Don, what is it like for you in South Korea to report on what's happening in North Korea?
Well, it can be quite frustrating. As you can imagine, you wind up talking to analysts and experts here in Washington and elsewhere. You get information from South Korean media and from broadcasts in South Korea. You also get information from Pyongyang's Korean Central News Agency. Not so much. Well, you get information as well as quotes. Most of them, reflecting the highest level of praise for Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-un. So you get insights that way, wish that you could have greater access to North Korea.
And a number of reports that have gotten out focused on famine and just the struggle that people are dealing with. What would you like to tell us about what is the reality of people living in North Korea? And how do you find out?
Deep famine has pervaded North Korea from the mid-1990s, when the famine was at its worst, when as many as 2 million people are said to have died from hunger and disease. That began in the mid-1990s. Now, it's not always that bad, but nonetheless, overall, the height of North Koreans is now, on average, 3 inches shorter than that of South Koreans, just to show how the growth of young people, have children and teenagers, is stunted by lack of food. So the famine, the hunger goes on, even if it's not always famine. And that's sort of a huge tragedy, which contrasts with the money that's lavished on the nuclear and missile programs. That's one of the deepest issues, that North Korea should be lavishing billions of the equivalent of billions of dollars on nuclear, on nukes and missiles, while most of the people go hungry, and many of them starve and suffer from illnesses for which there are not the facilities to provide cures. So it's a very desperate and tragic situation, and it's been going on for years. You have to wonder how many more years it can go on. It's a puzzle. Some people say, well, the regime, don't expect the regime to collapse anytime soon. It hasn't collapsed yet, and it's quite solid, and Kim Jong-un is in fact consolidating his power. So we'll see. The future is very hard to predict.
And what are you working on right now, Don?
Well, I've been working on this today for the past few days. And you know, I focus a lot on North Korea. I also focus on South Korean politics and, you know, the drama. This is a political year in South Korea. The reason these National Assembly elections were so important, one reason, is that they indicate who might win the presidential election in December. The feeling was that the Democratic Party might unseat President Lee. President Lee came to power in an election 5 years ago in 2007, ending 10 years of liberal rule in which President Kim Dae-jung, who won a Nobel Peace Prize, actually went to North Korea and initiated a sunshine policy of reconciliation. However, it doesn't seem, as if these elections are any guide, that the Democrats are going to really have that much of a chance. The front runner for the presidency here is a woman named Park Geun-hye, who's the daughter of Park Chung-hee, who ruled North Korea. I'm sorry, who ruled South Korea with an iron hand after seizing power in a coup in 1961. He was assassinated in 1979. His daughter Park Geun-hye looks like the front running candidate. But just one thing to add about her. She has actually visited North Korea. She met Kim Jong-il a few years ago. And even though she is a conservative, even though she's the daughter of this hardline leader, she may well want to adopt a more conciliatory policy toward North Korea.
And so, Don, we just have about a minute left before we go to break. In terms of this missile launch, where does this go from here? And if you were a reporter inside North Korea, what would your lead be? What would you want to write about?
Well, I would want to write probably what everybody else wants to write up there, namely, is there a possibility of a third nuclear test? And how is North Korea going to recover from this embarrassment? How are they going to sort of brazen their way through this and go on claiming scientific success and making all kinds of claims about their space program? In those launches in 1998 and 2009, in which the long-range missile did go 1,500 or so kilometers, they claim to have put satellites into orbit. No one saw. No scientists have been able to see these satellites in orbit. It's assumed that's all a hoax. And it's assumed that they had no intention this time of putting a satellite into orbit either. So those are questions one's going to ask. What about this satellite? What about the nuclear test? One also wants to get insights into real life in North Korea.
Right. I was actually going to say, is it...
And one doesn't really get them that way.
Is it safe...
You get taken on these guided tours.
Is it safe to assume that over the next few days, these reporters will be closely monitored and will not be allowed to wander off and talk to average people?
It's very safe to assume that. It's totally safe. And by the way, when you see reporters quoting people on the street, you can be sure that they were people who were in monitored conversations in which their minders were standing by. So don't think that those quotes are really, you know, vox pop, the voice of the people. They're the voice of selected people saying what they need to say in order to survive. Wow. Nobody on the streets of Pyongyang is going to start criticizing the regime or start saying this missile is a whole lot of money. Nobody who values his life and his safety is about to say that to any visiting foreign correspondent or even to any North Korean.
Well, Don Kirk, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Don Kirk. He's Korea correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. And it's our weekly media roundtable. When we come back, we'll switch gears and discuss coverage of the recently signed Jobs Act and the ongoing foreclosure crisis. You can join us 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
Well, if you're listening to Your Call right now, you and 10,000 other listeners are in good company. That's how many tune into KALW, not at 91.7 FM, but via our online streams at kalw.org. So if you're traveling outside the Bay Area, or you just sometimes encounter the limits of our humble little signal, the on-stream way to listen is the best way to stay connected. And if you have a smartphone, you can listen on your iPhone, your Android, or your BlackBerry. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show, yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we will mark Record Stores Day, which is April 21st. What is your favorite record store? How have the economics of running independent record stores changed? And do record stores still matter now that you can download just about anything? And on Tuesday, we will mark Tax Day, by talking about taxes at the federal level. How should we talk about changing the tax system? We talked about taxes at the state level recently, and on Tuesday we'll talk about federal taxes. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And today it's our weekly media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're going to talk now about coverage of the recently signed Jobs Act bill. The White House says it will create jobs. Critics say it legalizes even more Wall Street fraud. So did you see facts in the media coverage of this Jobs Act? And were your questions answered? We'll also be talking about the ongoing foreclosure crisis. There are connections here, but we're not really seeing them in most reports. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What really stood out for you this week? Do you have kudos you'd like to give to a reporter who did a good job, or maybe some criticism? 866-798-8255. You can also leave your story at yourcallradio.org so others can see it. And today we are joined by Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with the Huffington Post. He is going to talk with us about coverage of the Jobs Act, and he is also writing about the Buffett rule, which is getting a lot of attention. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And we're also joined by Paul Keel, reporter with ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative news outlet. Paul's latest piece is The Great American Foreclosure Story, The Struggle for Justice and a Place to Call Home. This story is also being published as an ebook for all devices, and it's available as an Amazon Kindle single. It's a lengthy, lengthy piece that really goes in depth about the foreclosure crisis. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So why don't we start off by talking about the Jobs Act? Michael, this is being touted as a jobs creator, and it's called the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. It was the brainchild of President Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. 19 corporate execs sit on this board. It's the heads of GE, Intel, Citigroup, Boeing, American Express. There are also slots awarded to labor. One was filled by AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. And your colleague at the Huffington Post, Jim Baines, wrote an article, Obama Jobs Act Leaves Labor Fuming in Democratic Field. So that's getting some attention. And then it's being touted as a jobs creator. And then you've got Matt Taibbi over at Rolling Stone saying that it's going to make Wall Street fraud. It'll legalize even more Wall Street fraud. So overall, what did you make of the coverage?
Well, the coverage seemed to mostly focus on the fact that it was a large bipartisan majority that passed the bill in both the House and the Senate. I think it was around 74, 75 in the Senate, and it was a strong vote in the House as well. And then the president signed it into law. So it was one of those rare moments of bi-party unity that we haven't seen very much of lately. But there weren't a lot of people talking about some of the things you've just been mentioning, and that seems to be a sort of growing concern amongst folks who really follow finance in this country.
So talk about some of that. Just to quote Matt Taibbi, he says, in fact, one could say this law is not just a sweeping piece of deregulation that will have an increase in securities fraud as an accidental consequence. No, this law actually appears to have been specifically written to encourage fraud in the stock markets. And the SEC even said this law isn't a good idea.
Yeah, there was one of the regulators at the SEC, I'm trying to remember her name, I think it was Lynn Turner, who suggested this would, in fact, do away with all kinds of investor protections and that it won't create jobs and it'll simply simplify fraud, I believe, were her very close to her exact words. I mean, the difficulty with it is that it removes certain reporting requirements that any company that wants to go public had to go through, because that's a relatively expensive process, and really small companies didn't want to do it. So what this does is it gets rid of a lot of this sort of required audited reporting and essentially lets somebody make what they call a pre-presentation, and they can do it over the internet. They can flog it along in those Google ads, et cetera, and they don't have to back it up with any kind of audited statements. And they can stay in that window for up to 5 years without any actual documented financial information on the company. So folks see that as just, well, you're going to find lots of people taking advantage of that.
And Paul, your colleague Jesse Eisinger, who's been on the show several times, his headline on this was Congress's genius jobs plan for fraudsters, shills, and Wall Street analysts. So he clearly didn't hold back on just the outline of what's in this bill.
No, he took a kind of a Swiftian approach to it, lauding it very sarcastically as a way to really, you know, get jobs in the fraud sector booming type thing. But I mean, I think with this bill, it's been a broader pattern of opinion calmness actually being pretty on to this, you know, weeks ahead of it passing through Congress, and you only saw, you know, significant news coverage after it kind of already went through.
And Jesse reports, finally, the House passed a jobs bill, and what a bill it is. Officially called the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, it calls for reopening our capital markets to exciting new startups by ridding protections for investors and stripping away disclosure requirements for smaller companies. So what explains this, and why isn't this getting more attention?
What explains this is, I mean, obviously if you put the title anything the Jobs Act, it makes it much more politically palatable. And, you know, a lot of times technical aspects of bills might escape, you know, reporters' attention until, you know, finally it's written into law.
Yeah, you know, there's another part of that. The whole idea of crowdfunding is kind of a cool-sounding thing, you know, where you think about getting a bunch of friends together to help launch a company or that Kickstarter program that helps with music acts and movies and things like that. It has a certain appeal, so, you know, people hear about it and they're not put off by it at all right away. And I don't think anyone was really too concerned about it until Mary Shapiro at the SEC wrote a letter to senators warning them that there was a real problem with that. And that's when you actually saw, I think it was about 22 senators either change their minds or become more public about it and vote against the bill.
Matt Taibbi says the law also rolls back rules designed to prevent bank analysts from talking up a stock just to win business, a practice that was so pervasive in the tech boom years as to be almost industry standard. So how do you explain this after the 1990 bust, the recent financial crisis, and we still have so much of this going unchecked?
Well, there is a true problem in there, which is that startups, small startups like that, have declined, and investing in startups have declined, and the most new jobs come from young, rapidly growing companies. So they were looking around for ways to sort of, you know, boost that a little bit, and that's what they came up with. But they're willing to overlook some of the potential problems. One rationale I heard from someone in the White House was that, well, if you're trying to start a company and you know that in 5 years you'll have to make everything public, are you really going to subject yourself to potential imprisonment and fraud charges by either local or federal officials? The idea is that, you know, not that many people will, but as you've seen from the outpouring of opinion across the internet, that a lot of folks disagree with that,
including a lot of people in labor.
Yeah, I'm not honestly sure what the labor side of that issue is, quite frankly, because you're talking about really tiny companies that aren't really unionized, but maybe someday they would be. So I'm not really sure what exactly their issue is.
Paul, do you know what their issue is?
No, sorry, I don't.
Well, according to your colleague, the tech industry is on one side of the fight and organized labor is on the other side of the fight.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's worth reflecting back to the early part of, you know, the 2000s when you had, you know, Wall Street analysts like Henry Blodgett writing in emails calling stocks, you know, worthless, you know,
right.
This and that, and then publicly going on TV and touting things. And I mean, I would be, you know, interested to know if that sort of activity would be essentially blessed by this.
Yeah, and it sounds like labor sees this as Democrats really siding with Silicon Valley and not really giving labor anything in this Jobs Act. So it seems like that's the issue that they have with this bill, is they didn't get anything out of it.
Right, and I mean, there are a lot of Democrats eager to seem pro-business, so that is something that's definitely... It goes on.
Right. And so, you know, when we were putting this show together and thinking about the Jobs Act, and then, Paul, we found your extensive story about the ongoing foreclosure crisis. We were kind of making connections between this, because if it allows for even more Wall Street fraud rather than a crackdown on Wall Street fraud, and the reason why we're in such a horrible foreclosure crisis is because of what happened on Wall Street, what does this mean for the future of foreclosures? And are we stretching it by trying to make a connection between these two?
Well, I don't know that it's stretching it. I mean, it is worth reflecting. There, you know, in the big financial reform bill, the Dodd-Frank bill, there were some reforms that were meant to essentially prevent the type of really abusive lending that went on during the housing boom. What Congress has been really bad at and hasn't really done anything on is turning its attention to the aftermath of that, which is the foreclosure crisis. And essentially what you've seen the Obama administration do is have to kind of go around Congress to do what they can without Congress. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of those measures have been so weak and ineffective.
And your piece, The Great American Foreclosure Story, The Struggle for Justice and a Place to Call Home, is about a 58-year-old grandmother, Sheila Ramos, and her three grandsons. She lost her three-bedroom in Florida and ended up pitching a tent on a family-owned patch of land on Hawaii's Big Island. First of all, how did you find her?
Well, I've been reporting on this for about 3 years now, and we've actually heard from thousands of people. We use that to drive our reporting. And so we knew we wanted to do this story to kind of do a story, and I've described it as giving a 360-degree view of one foreclosure. We wanted to find someone who would allow us to talk about all the different problems that went into the crisis. And she was someone who, you know, was, you know, a victim of predatory lending and then, you know, ended up in the foreclosure machine, and there was robo-signing in her case. Mm-hmm. So she allowed us to talk about kind of the whole mess with one person. So, and she was very willing to have me, you know, spend hours interviewing her and going through all her documents, that sort of thing. So it worked out.
And you report that banks have foreclosed on more than 4 million homes since the crisis began in 2007, with almost 6 million loans still in danger of foreclosure. This year could be the worst year yet.
Yeah, so we have... there's been the height, actually, in terms of homes that were sold through foreclosure was 2010. It was a little over 1 million homes that were sold, which is, you know, way above normal levels. But we've had this huge backlog for a number of reasons. One, because the banks are just overwhelmed and aren't willing to invest in this part of their business, but also because we had the robo-signing crisis. You know, they were breaking laws and how they were foreclosing on people. And so that settlement, the $25 billion settlement that everyone heard about, you know, back in February was first announced, you know, announced by the Justice Department and the Attorneys General. That was kind of what they were waiting for in terms of starting to move through that backlog, the millions of people who are in this pipeline. And so you really could see them kind of ramp up the machine a little bit. And I definitely think it's possible that you could see more than a million foreclosure sales in 2012 and even continuing into 2013.
You write that we've got robo-signing, which is getting a lot of attention, but also an array of business practices dating to the 90s that were designed to skirt laws and fatten profits. The federal and state governments largely tolerated these practices until they pushed Ramos into a tent and all of us into the Great Depression. So what about these business practices? Are they still on the books?
Yeah, there's been a lot of them that are controversial. I mean, one in particular is there's this system called MERS, which they use essentially it was a way they were, you know, these loans are being securitized and sold all over Wall Street, and it was a real hassle to have to go to, you know, the county and file like new property, you know, papers every time they transferred ownership of the loan. And so the solution they came up with was, well, let's just have this entity kind of serve as a placeholder. And then that entity will keep track of all the ownership of the loan and the transfers of ownership. And, of course, that's a very not transparent system. They've set it up now where, like, a homeowner can go online and search their database. But who knows to do that, right? Mm. And it's kind of it became part of the problem because it made it all the more easy for them to be really sloppy in how they were documenting ownership of these loans. And MERS is still around. You know, there's been lots of court cases. They lost some, they won some. The New York's Attorney General sued MERS and other banks, basically accusing them of fraud. And so that goes on, but it hasn't disappeared. It's still there. And there's other practices we talk about where there has been a little bit of crackdown. For instance, Countrywide kind of pioneered this idea of investing in essentially the businesses that are involved in foreclosing on people. So you need like a trustee who's going to actually do the legal things required to foreclose, even, you know, investing in companies that do like, you know, lawn mowing and checking, doing property inspections and that kind of stuff. So they described it as a quote-unquote counter-cyclical strategy, essentially, you know, hey, lots of people are going through foreclosure, but we're making money because all these businesses that we own are getting a lot of business. And they ended up getting dinged by the FTC, basically for overbilling customers and coming up with a bunch of bogus charges. But that's something that's still they got dinged again when the $25 billion settlement came out. That was part of that, is they had to pay more money to the FTC because they had, even after getting, you know, sued by the government, they went back and did some of the same things.
That is Paul Keel. He's a reporter with ProPublica. His latest piece, it's a lengthy piece, The Great American Foreclosure Story, The Struggle for Justice and a Place to Call Home. And he reports that we might see even more foreclosures than ever this year. And we're also joined by Michael McAuliffe. He's a reporter with the Huffington Post, senior congressional correspondent who covers taxes and Washington. And if you have a question or comment about media coverage of really important legislation like the Jobs Act or the foreclosure crisis, it sounds like things are even going to get worse this year. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And Michael, we just had a caller who said, why is it that media outlets and journalists tend to cover legislation after it's signed into law? Where's the coverage beforehand so we can actually maybe do something about this?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the bill and the discussion in the larger, you know, country as a whole. If you remember the payroll tax debate, the coverage of that was quite extensive long before there was actually even a bill. And then each step along the way, as it fell apart and came back together, was covered quite vigorously by everybody involved. But I mean, that could be part of the reason why this crowd sourcing thing didn't get all that much coverage, because it was sort of in the shadow of a lot of other things that were moving along, including the presidential campaign. So I don't think it was any deliberate, or it's just one of those things that happens. And if it had been the only thing that was happening, it would have gotten quite a bit more coverage.
Yeah, I had to chuckle there. All the important news coming out of the presidential campaign.
Right, I know.
I mean, it's just unbelievable watching that. But how do you decide what to focus on? Because you had an important story earlier this month. You report that a transportation bill worth $109 billion, actually it was last month, a transportation bill worth $109 billion and an estimated 3 million jobs stalled in the Senate last month amid battles over amendments that have little or nothing to do with transportation. You report that efforts to begin considering the measure were delayed by a failed 52-44 vote to end the debate. 60 votes were required. It almost got there. I mean, it just failed by 8. Even though it had little or nothing to do with transportation.
Right. Yeah, no, that happens all the time in the Senate. You know, you get stuff attached to bills, and you know, when I'm looking at this story, deciding whether or not to cover it, I'll usually pick something that I think is relatively important and also interesting. And then I'll just write about it. That's one of the nice things about the Huffington Post, is you have a great deal of freedom in choosing your own stories. We don't have an assignment desk. So I see something like that. I think it's interesting. I think it's important. And I write the story.
And Paul, what are your thoughts on this? How do you get legislation or important pieces of legislation out there so people can know what's actually going on behind all of the very important information we're getting about the presidential debates?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one in terms of getting through the noise and getting meaningful coverage. I mean, at ProPublica, we're kind of a completely different animal in that it's really driven what we think is important. Like, I've been writing about the foreclosure crisis, like, since 2009. Mm-hmm. And just kind of banging away at it. So, you know, a lot of times for reporters on beat, if there's nothing really happening on a particular beat, it can be easy, you know, the resources are in demand and you can get pulled off even if it's important.
And what about your piece, The Great American Foreclosure Story? This was an incredibly lengthy piece. Did you get much reaction from readers on this? And since you've been on the foreclosure beat for so long, what is your assessment of overall coverage of the foreclosure crisis?
Well, I mean, the first thing, we've gotten, a lot of positive reaction. I mean, the idea was to kind of put it in one place. There's a lot of moving parts. And, you know, there's some basic aspects of how banks handle these mortgages and why they've done such a poor job at it and how they're structured, their business is structured. That was important to explain, you know, all together in one place. And then also I thought it was important to kind of draw a straight line from, you know, the lending abuses of the subprime boom through the foreclosure crisis, because people tended to just think, well, these people got loans they couldn't afford and they got foreclosed on, and it's actually much more complicated than that. There was a system that was set up that was kind of pushed people towards foreclosure instead of helping them to avoid it. So it's kind of one, two sides of the same coin. Sorry, what was the second part of your question?
What is your overall assessment of how the media are covering the ongoing foreclosure crisis?
Right, there have been good, some good stories. I mean, as I said earlier, there oftentimes has to be a news hook, or if something is seen as kind of a problem that's not really going to be fixed anytime soon, you know, you'll see coverage die off.
Uh-oh. Paul, are you still there?
Yeah.
We're losing your connection.
Sorry. At a certain point, we were hearing from so many homeowners around the country that we set up a system where we would refer people to local reporters, and we were able to facilitate a number of stories that way. So sometimes it was easy. We were able to actually help coverage in other outlets just by providing them with people who had a story to tell. But there was a real flare-up in coverage on this issue when the robo-signing crisis hit. That was in the fall of 2010 and into early 2011. But since then you've really seen, you know, die off in the amount of coverage.
Right. Even though there's so much happening on the streets, the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco put a moratorium on foreclosures. Occupy movements across the country are trying to get banks to put moratoriums or at least renegotiate the mortgages. What does that look like right now in terms of banks renegotiating mortgages at a time when a report came out this week got actually decent amount of coverage that Wall Street banks are tripling their bonuses in a bidding war over top brokers?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I really try to explain in the piece is, you know, how is it that the Bank of America, which is, in terms of loans, the largest mortgage servicer, how is it that they are, you know, they do such a poor job? You know, we quoted an employee at one of their call centers saying, like, you know, I work for a bank that has, like, tons of money, and why can't I get a fax from a customer? Like, he describes this process where he'll tell someone to fax something, he'll check, and it's not there. He'll tell them to fax it again, and they'll check, you know, that sort of thing. And it's because these are just a segment of their business. The vast majority of the loans they handle, they don't actually own, so they don't hold the risk of a loss from foreclosure. And it's led to essentially real lack of investment in that side of their business. And so, you know, if that sector is overwhelmed, if they have employees who don't know what they're doing because they're not adequately trained and don't have an adequate experience, and that's just sort of a byproduct. And they've been pretty content to muddle through it. The only real exception has been, you know, the robo-signing crisis, where there was actually some sort of crackdown by the government, and now we're kind of entering a new period where, because of that big settlement, the attorneys general put in place a guy that's called a monitor, and his job is to keep an eye on the banks and then make sure that they're doing actually reviewing people to make sure that they can't restructure or modify the loan rather than foreclose, and if they're not following the rules that have been set out, supposedly this monitor will have the power to penalize them for millions of dollars. But, and I've been covering this for a while, and I've heard tough talk from the government before, so I think, you know, I'm taking a wait-and-see approach.
Hmm. Did you see the news about Iceland forgiving the mortgage debt for much of its population?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it just came down last night, and it's getting so much attention on Facebook. Yeah, they're forgiving mortgage debt for the majority of their population. I'll put the link on our website. So, Paul, what are you working on right now?
Well, I've actually been doing interviews all week, and one thing on this beat that I'll stay on is one major thing that came out of the crisis was federal banking regulators finally woke up and paid attention to how banks were handling people and instituted what they call the independent foreclosure review. They are looking at anyone who was in foreclosure in the years of 2009, 2010, and they say it's a population of about 4.3 million people. These are basically customers who people had their loan handled by the biggest banks. And they're going to be reviewing those loans to see if there are any abuses involved. And if there was what they call, quote unquote, financial injury to the borrower, and an example of that would be, you know, you never should have ended up in foreclosure in the first place, and they started tacking all these foreclosure fees. If the review comes out and finds that you were hurt that way, supposedly you're going to get a check from the bank.
Quickly, I mean, but it seems like the SEC has been sidelined again on this. And Michael, just quickly, what are you working on?
Well, I'm taking a look at the two different approaches in the House and the Senate on taxes that will be highlighted this week. In the Senate, they're going to vote on this Buffett rule,
right,
where you would make millionaires pay at least 30%, or people who earn $1 million in a year at least 30%. And meanwhile, in the House, they're going to be looking at cutting taxes for extremely successful small businesses.
All right. Well, we're going to focus on that on tax day. Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with the Huffington Post, and Paul Keel, reporter with ProPublica. Thank you both for joining us. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What's your favorite record store? On the next Jorah Call, we'll have a conversation about independent record stores. April 21st is Record Stores Day. With over 700 independently owned record stores, what's the value of a brick-and-mortar outlet selling music in the digital age? How have the economics of running an independent record store changed? And do these stores still matter now that you can download just about anything? It's Jorah Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Thorne. As a piano player, Robert Glasper draws from both jazz and hip-hop. Even at the age of 14, he was listening to Keith Jarrett, A Tribe Called Quest, and Bonnie Raitt.
My mixtapes are very random. My friends would get in my car and be like,
huh?
They'd be like nodding to The Tribe Called Quest, but you keep riding, and in about 10 minutes,
turn down the lights.
My interview with Robert Glasper on Bullseye from PRI.
You can hear Bullseye at 4 p.m. this Sunday. That's 4 p.m. on the 15th of April, right here on KALW, 91.7 FM, San Francisco, your local public radio station. And some of you may have noticed that you have not received our latest program guide. Don't worry, it should be arriving soon due to postal delays. It's backed up a little bit. In the meantime, you can view a PDF of the guide at our website, kalw.org.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGarvin. Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say. There's a photo that has sparked outrage.
This picture symbolizes the fact that these Roma gangs abuse their children for criminal purposes.
A young, dirty-faced Roma boy pointing a gun at the camera is on the front of a Swiss magazine with the headline, "The Roma are coming. They come, they steal, they go." You can see the picture right now on our Facebook page. But across Europe, many have said that they are angry at the cover, calling it racist. The magazine says the photo depicts a real problem: Roma gangs making their children commit crimes. Coming up, we'll chat to Roma guests and also the editor of the magazine. If you'd like to take part, why don't you Skype us right now? Our address is BBC_WHY.